Ecclesiastes chapter 7, and if you notice in your little outline on the book of Ecclesiastes, and the theme is life really worth living, and trying to find an answer under the sun, as our writer Solomon, King Solomon, tells us, you're not going to find much of an answer, and for good reason. The only answers come from over the sun. You have to have divine interpretation of your life. It's kind of like the owner's manual. We read the scriptures because it tells us who we are, tells us who God is, and tells us why we were created. And so it tells us also how to live. So as we get into chapter 7, if you'll notice on your outline, as he's discussing these problems and details that he's laid out in Ecclesiastes 1 and 2, he's now going to move into this whole idea of the vanity of wisdom. He kind of brought up this whole subject of wisdom in chapter 1, if you remember, verse 12 through 18, about how, you know, basically the guy who's wise doesn't really have a leg up on anybody else, not as if he's going to make his life this, that, or whatever. Because he says in verse 12, I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done in heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. Wow. Kind of going on a wisdom journey, and this is the conclusion of it. He says in verse 16 of chapter 1, I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. My heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Wow, that's going to be a nice endeavor. I want to be wise. Well, get ready. Bring your Kleenex box with you, because it's going to take an awful lot to realize that it's going to be a sorrowful endeavor. But when he gets to chapter 7, and you also see this in the outline, when he discusses these problems, and not just the monotony of life we saw, and then the futility of wealth, we move now to the vanity of wisdom. But as he sees and gets into the whole idea of wisdom, it's not like he's going to kill it off, as if he shouldn't do that, as if folly's the answer. Folly's never the answer. But he's going to bring out some aspects that you see in your outline about wisdom, that there are some things about wisdom that are way more profitable than folly. We make life better with it. We see life clearer with it, as he says. And number three, we face life stronger, being wiser. So there's some things that wisdom will provide to you in your journey, in your life, in your vain life, as he would say, under the sun, that's profitable. But at the end of the day, once again, as he gets to the end of his book, life under the sun, in all of its rhymes and reasons, isn't going to make any sense, even if you claim to be the wisest man on earth, because where there's much wisdom and much knowledge, there's great sorrow. So this first little section that we want to look at this morning, and the point he made earlier, the vanity of wisdom, but now trying to give three positive contributions that wisdom makes to our lives. And it's interesting that 14 times he's going to use wisdom in these two chapters, because that's what he's dealing with here. He says, first of all, wisdom can make life better. And he's going to say this in chapter 7, 1 through 10. So let's read our text in verse 1. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. It is better, here's that word better again, which he's going to use an awful many times. He's going to say, it is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of myrrh. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fools. This also is vanity. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning. And the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. So let's kind of break this down a little bit. What does he say here in this first part of wisdom can make life better? What does he say about the first thing? You notice the first thing, he talks about how sorrow is better than laughter. Why is sorrow better than laughter? What does he say in verses 1 through 4? He talks about how it's better to go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting. Verse 3, sorrow is better than laughter. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. I mean, the guy's just obsessing over sorrow? How do we know that? You're right. Where does he say that? Verse 2, for this is the end of all mankind. The living will lay it to heart. See, in other words, there's things that take place in mourning that you're going to think about the bigger picture than you never would in a fit of laughter or myrrh and celebration and things of that sort. It just doesn't lend itself to sobriety as a general rule. Where many times when you're confronted with sorrow and the brevity of life or things that have been taken away from you, you begin to realize that these broader principles of who I am, how I'm made, how transient I am, come to the forefront. Now, what does this verse 1 mean with ointments and all of this other stuff? What are you trying to say here? A good name is better than precious ointment in the day of death than the day of birth. Care to wager an interpretation on that? Right. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. You know, the word ointment, kind of like I'm thinking, okay, let me see. Do I want to have a good name or do I want to have a lot of Bengay on hand? You know, ointments or something. One of the things that we don't get in the Hebrew is there's a play on words here, which I don't know. I got to be told this. It's the name Shem in the Hebrew, and ointment is Shemen. So he's working off of this play on words so that when the Hebrew reader would read this, he'd recognize the interplay between ointment and name, a good name and a good ointment. People use ointments, in whether it's perfume or ointment in here, could be for medicinal reasons, healing reasons. You know, when you're thinking of a person in pain, you know, you reach for the ointment. But, you know, if you're going to have pain, better to have a physical pain than having a mental one, a regretful pain. That's why the second part where he talks about in the day of death than the day of birth, because the point being is that on the day of your birth, Frank Fasula was given a name. But on the day of Frank's death, that name's going to mean something now. That's that day of death now. We're going to be able to say, this is what the Frank Fasula meant. As I say, the dash between the 19 whatever to the 2000 whatever, that little dash is the life he leads. And so that day of death means, wow, anybody can get a name when they're born. The parents give them a name all the time. These are, significant days in a person's life, the beginning and at the very end. You get a name at the beginning, but what does it mean? Nothing. But when you get a name at the end, a character attached to that name and a reputation and an admiration, now that's something that, yeah. That day of death is going to be better than the day of birth when it comes to names. And let me tell you, that is better than an ointment. See, that good name. See, a man's name is better on that day because of the way he lived than it was simply the day of birth and simply just having an ointment to heal something physically. Yeah, you got people take pain pills all the time to heal something. But let me tell you something. If you want to deal with the mental aspect, and you want to, have some peace of mind, work on the name. Work on your name so that the day of death you can say, this is what I am at the day of my death. And that whatever I am, God's got to give that pronouncement, kind of like Frank says, so that we have a name in heaven. We have a name written in the Lamb's Book of Life, but that name is given. That's also part of a character that I have at the end of that life, too. That when people say, hey, you remember Frank Fasula? Yeah, I sure do. That's that brother that, and they talk about how good that name is. You see, somebody had a hand up? Rodney, you had his hand up? Wiersbe says that every man has three names. One his father and mother give him, one others call him, and then the one he acquires for himself, which is the truth. You know, in Proverbs 10, it says, the memory of the just is blessed, but the name of the wicked shall rot. You know, I guess when his dad gave him H. Conrad Murrell as a name, it was just a name on a birth certificate. They didn't read it. They didn't write a book about him when he was born, right? They write one now. That's at the end of his life, because of all the things that God did through him and the encouragement that he was, and the things that he glorified the Lord and encouraged the saints in. So at the day of one's death, you know, when you reckon, it's not like, you know, you're going to a funeral for someone who was born that day and died that day. You don't know them. You know, they was given a name, but that's pretty much it. This person crafted an entire lifetime of character and an influence. And we started, when we were going up to Bentley, we started talking about the different ways. And I know when I talked to some people up there that Conrad has influenced all of us. I mean, many, many of us wouldn't even know our spouses. It wouldn't be for Conrad. We never would have known about Bentley. We never even would have known about any of those people. And the people he touched, and then those people he touched all the way down the line. Here was this man with a great name because of that. Think of also, I like what one guy says, you know, in the first century, you know, Nero ruled the world, and he had a nobody, Paul the Apostle, put to death. But, you know, 21 centuries later, we name our children Paul, we name our dogs Nero. You know, it's still, that's not a name you want to have, is Nero. Yeah, what's your name? Nero. Unless, I don't know, unless you order pizza somewhere, I guess. But same thing with Judas. I mean, who names their kids Judas? I mean, if you think about it, you know, it's like the name has become, you know, unsavory, to say the least. So, anything else? I talked about in verse 2, it's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Here's that sorrow aspect again at the day of death, that we learn more from a funeral home than we will tailgating in a LSU game. And if you really learn about the lessons in life, this is where you're going to learn them. You're going to learn them in church many times. People, not only come to church because it's going to make me think. It's going to make me think about eternal things. It's going to make me think about the future and things of the shortness of my life. And people don't like going to church. And people, you know, the only time you see them is at weddings and funerals. You know, because why? Because they recognize this. Not so much that we're like a funeral or day of mourning or a house of mourning. But many times in houses of mourning, it forces you to sober up that this person is not here anymore. That all of their best laid plans are naught. I don't know. I mean, we all have plans, but God can take them away in an instant, and all of a sudden you're left with that reality. So when you go to that day of mourning, it's very easy to put your hands over your ears and say, I don't want to hear this, that my life is this short, or it can end this soon. I mean, I'm sure Will Smith had a lot of things on his plate with calendars and all these other things before he got gunned down the street in New Orleans. But that calendar is now moot. And so when you go to the house in the morning, while you say, you know, we're going to miss him, you need to think beyond that, saying, that's going to be me in that box one day. You know, and this happens to every person. See, as he says here, and the living will lay it to heart. They're going to learn that, they're going to connect the dots between the casket and themselves, between what's going on here, and they lay them in the ground saying, you know, I don't know, maybe that might be the greatest anomaly in the universe, but I don't think I'm going to die. You can believe that, right? But you're working against the odds. I mean, casinos wouldn't even have those odds stacked in their favor. Everything stacks so much against you. Because you begin to realize, why do people take out, you know, burial insurance? They begin to believe that one day I'm going to go back to the ground. Well, funeral or house of mourning has a way of slapping that reality into you. So, first point, as he talks about that sorrow is better than laughter. The second one he says in verse 5 and 6 is what? Rebuke is better than praise. Say that word better again. What does it say in 5 and 6? It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. Song and gaiety and things of this sort where there's no substance. You got yes men around you. They're telling you what you want to hear. You think of, what was it in 1 Kings 22 when all the yes men of Ahab, the prophet, you know, when Jehoshaphat wanted to know where they're going to battle, and he says, well, these people are going to tell you what you want to hear. I need a real prophet. So they go get Micaiah, and of course he comes in there and reads them the riot act. But he won't listen to it, see. So, but they have real men, real people who will come in and tell you the truth, and tell you the truth in the context, and will weigh things and say, well, it's not 100% zero, but it's probably 60-40 here. I mean, your parents are like that in a great way with you as children. They'll tell you the truth. Your spouse is that way. Your friends should be that way. Brethren should be that way. But notice the contrast, which you're not better off is that you hear the song of fools. And then he contrasts, he gives you a metaphor of the song of fools in verse 6, where as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fools. This also is vanity. Why that metaphor? What does that mean? Once again, another Hebrew play on words here. Song being sheer, pot being sir, and thorns being sirim. Kind of the words that sound a lot like each other. Crackling of thorns under a pot makes a lot of sounds, popping and things of this sort. But it doesn't accomplish much. It's kind of like, okay, watch out. It might shoot out some sparks or something. You know, you don't want to catch on fire. But it doesn't help you. That's the point he's trying to make here. Rebuke is better than praise. Many, many passages in the book of Proverbs, this writer has given us in Proverbs 10:17, 12:1, 15:5, 17:10, 25, 12, all about rebuke, rebuke, rebuke. What's he say in verse 7 through 9? Talks about, surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning. And the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. What's he trying to say here in these three verses? In the better category. What's he trying to contrast in the realm of wisdom here? That something's better than something else. Why does he talk about bribery? Oppression. Then he talks about the end is better than the beginning. The patient in spirit. The man who's not given to anger. What would be the context of what he's trying to hone in on these three verses? I think it's, as Wiersbe brings out, I think he hits the nail on the head. Better is the long haul than the shortcut. Because when you take a bribe, you're taking a shortcut. When you try to oppress, you're trying to put down something, you're taking a shortcut. Now think about that. Think about all the shortcuts you've taken in life and you've regretted because you had to double back on your endeavors, and all it does is cost you. You think about people once, you think about a person who goes and he embezzles $10,000. So he goes to jail for 5 years and he's got to pay 10,000 plus penalties and things of this sort. So I'm thinking, how was that shortcut? How did that shortcut help you here? Not only did you have to pay the money back, and you had to pay restitution on top of that, and all kind of penalty fines on top of that, and then you lost 5-10 years of your life. Wow. You made, really, the regular haul longer, way longer than it was supposed to, because you bought into the what? The folly, not the wisdom, the folly of the shortcut. Look at Joseph. God tells Joseph, that the sun, moon, and stars and all these things are going to be bowing down to him. He tells his brothers that, and all of a sudden he gets thrown into slavery and things of this sort. Now, he could have taken many shortcuts, couldn't he? If I really want to get ahead with Potiphar, maybe I need to lay with Potiphar's wife. Maybe I need to tell the king, the Pharaoh, what he needs to hear. He doesn't do that. He stays in prison. Talk about long haul. Who's going to say, I got the best program for you to be a great Christian, and that program is going to require trials and tribulations and distress. You ready? Sure, there isn't a shortcut? When Christ is being tempted in the wilderness, and he tells them, just do this and do this. Worship me and all these are yours. Shortcut. Shortcut. You're hungry? Turn the stones to bread. Shortcut. All of them are temptation to shortcut. But then that's the way of folly. Taking the bribe. Buckling underneath when you're being oppressed. When you're having that anger because of that. I think that's why he brings up anger in verse 9. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry. See, it's a shortcut. Well, I'm going to teach them a lesson. Well, I'm going to give them a piece of my mind. That's a shortcut. Why would you do that? Who made you a teacher? Who made you ruler over them? How do you know they're going to listen to you in the first place? See, wisdom backs off of just doing things out of anger. Anger lodges in the bosom of fools. You don't want to do that. You want to go on this thing, guns blazing and all of that somehow. Well, they might need that. But who made you that person that's going to do that? Yeah, but they're my wife. Or they're my husband. So what? Who made you their master? Who made you their teacher? How do you know this is not going to come back on you and boomerang, and now you're putting out 5 other fires because of your anger? All of a sudden, that shortcut becomes an even longer haul than what if you just been patient and stay the course. I think the same thing he talks about when he talks about the end of a thing is better than its beginning. And the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Look in verse 10, he talks about another better. What does he say in verse 10? Say not, where were the former days better than these? Why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Ah, the good old days. And the last one is, somehow today, I don't know. He says, why were the former days better than these? Ah, the good old days in the past. yesterday better than today. Remember when they wept when they were building the second temple in the book of Ezra? I think it was in chapter 3. Ah, the good old days when we had Solomon's temple. And when they were building the temple and they were laying the foundation, remember what they were doing? Remember what happened? They wept. You had people who were crying because they were crying. Because this, look how little it is. We used to live in a mansion before God and we're just building this little one-bedroom trailer here. We're going to worship God. So the fathers, the old guys there who saw that and could compare it, wished for the better days of the past. Where the people there at the present who never saw that, who were younger, said, yes, we're out of Babylon and we're out of, you know, captivity with the Persians. We got our own place. This is our own place. We're God in the temple. We're excited. And it says in Ezra 3 that the sound, you couldn't distinguish between happiness and sadness. And it was all in the perspective. You got people crying over something small, and you know, other people rejoicing over something at all. If you think about it. And so what he's saying is, don't get caught up into the trap of thinking, ah, the old days. And we do that a lot. We go back into the nostalgia realm, and we live in the past. And we say, boy, I remember those days. Boy, they were way better than today. Yeah, I got to tell you something. According to wisdom here, no, they weren't. Now, you could think back in those days. Back then, you say, oh, life was simpler. Well, guess what? It might have been simpler, but guess who else was simpler? You were a simpleton back then. You don't know what you know now. You can't take what you know now and go back there and live that life. No, you've got to be dumbed down during that time in the 70s and things of the sort, in the 80s. If you can go back into the good old days. They're not the good old days. They're just days. And so in wisdom, we just learn from it. You should be wiser today. So in a lot of ways, today's better than yesterday. Not thinking that, well, yesterday's better than today. Even if we have loss, God brings us through all things, some through the, you know, water, some through the flood, you know, some through the fire, but then all through the blood. And as we recognize, and we can say, yeah, this is an evil thing. This evil, obviously, is not good in and of itself, but what's going to take place is I'm going to be a better person as a result of it. God promises that in Romans 8, you know, 28, in James chapter 1. So be careful. Wisdom makes things better. That's the whole point of these 10 verses here in Ecclesiastes. But he makes things better only if you take on the perspective of what God's doing. So whether it's mourning over, you know, laughter, or whether it's rebuke over praise, or whether it's, you know, the long haul over the shortcut, all these things, you know, today versus yesterday, you got to keep in mind that what God's doing, I'm growing in wisdom. And if I'm growing in wisdom and taking the God perspective, then everything's the way it's supposed to be. And I'm where I need to be. I'm one day wiser, but I'm also one day older. And I get that. And if I can go one day wiser and become wiser as a result of it, then everything's on course. I've learned something. I'm not the fool, the crackling underneath a pot or something, or I'm living for the tailgate moment. And when I hang and want to be around people who live for the tailgate moment, then I'm going to sacrifice and say, I don't want to live for the sorrow moment. I mean, who does want to be sorrowful? But the righteous take it to heart. That's why we, in church, constantly are encouraging you and instructing you on how to view times of sorrow and times of distress. So that if you don't take the right perspective, knowing, see, the testing of your faith produces endurance, and you're going to look at trials in a whole different way. And you're going to look at it like a fool. And you're going to talk like the crackling of thorns under a pot. We don't want you to do that. We want you to be able to speak in wisdom and to be able to praise the Lord for what he's doing, because we have a divine aspect of why everything happens in our lives. And we have great examples in our fellowship of people who've gone through those things, and we've seen how God has brought them through and given them more mental sanity than anybody else out there in the asylum called Planet Earth can offer through medication or through therapy or anything else. Why? Because this is the owner's manual. Even the book of Ecclesiastes is telling us this. It's your perspective on how you define your pain in this kind of life, and how you define your friends and your enemies, and how you define counsel that's going to progress you in the road to be more of a fool or more of a sage. So, any questions on this section in Ecclesiastes 7, 1 through 10? We'll look at another aspect of wisdom next week, Lord willing. So, let's pray.